Well, we didn't mention it too much, maybe, but we did say that part of how we know or think we know that the race is close in New Hampshire currently is because of all that polling. I mean, if you've dared to turn on your TV this election season, this may sound familiar.
We have more results that have just come in from our poll of registered voters.
Plus, the first poll numbers just in.
Breaking tonight, we have two national polls just out, making four releases.
And on and on and on and on. Polls, polls everywhere. But maybe it's time to stop and ask, is all that polling good for us and for our democracy? Well, that's the question that Jill Lepore, Harvard historian and staff writer for The New Yorker, tackles in her latest article. It's titled Politics and the New Machine. And she joins us now. Jill Lepore, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's really great to have you. So can we just start with your expertise as a historian? Because I would love to walk back from the point we're at now to where sort of polling began in earnest in the United States, because you tell the story so beautifully in your New Yorker article. How did George Gallup, whose name we all associate with polling, how did he get into this?
I love this story. You know, the thing is, something like polling is everywhere right now. And I think, even though when I think about my childhood, I'm like, there weren't so many polls back then, were there? Well, it's true, there weren't. And if you, you know, investigate it archivally and follow the history down to its sources, it's a fairly new phenomenon. And it's not inevitable that we have these many polls. And it's not like a natural feature of American democracy, something that evolved. And when people always guess who's going to win an election. That's been going on since as long as there have been electoral contests, right? That's just fun. And I think a big piece of polling, right, is this super entertaining. So just to put that out there, I recognize that you'll find stuff really entertaining. A poll is the top of your head. And when people used to go to vote, you'd sort of have to go to one side of the town common to vote one way and the other side of the vote the other way. Counting the poll was actually people going around and counting the tops of your heads.
Literally.
Literally, on the top of your head. And it came to be, eventually the word evolved to mean the place where you would go to vote. And then when people started making predictions, specific kinds of predictions, those were also called polls. What George Gallup started in the 1930s and 1935 when he founded the American Institute of Public Opinion was what we think of as scientific polling or modern public opinion polling. And that's because Gallup, who was actually a journalist, primarily a journalist, and he considered public opinion surveying a form of journalism. And that's actually quite an important thing to remember. He founded his institute at Princeton because he wanted to make it seem academic, and he was, you know, he had a PhD in psychology, and he was borrowing from the methods of social science by using this sample survey method to gauge public opinion, which is a new application of a pre-existing method. But what he was really interested in doing was figuring out what Americans believe about issues.
Right.
We're doing surveys, not forecasting elections.
Yeah, because you in your piece, you even like quote something that Gallup said about, you know, what we recognize now as the typical horse race polls, that he said that such forecasts provide an interesting and legitimate activity. They probably serve no great social purpose.
Yeah, he was pretty, you know, he didn't come back to that later in his career because he realized how much people liked them. They were a very saleable product. But the thing about it, like, let's say your question is, you know, Do Americans support mandatory background checks for guns? Just to follow up on the story, Anthony Brooks was just reporting about Hillary's particular campaign angle at the moment. Well, okay, so let's say you hire a pollster who says, well, 40% of Americans do and 20% of Americans don't, and the other, you know, the remainder don't know. Well, I don't know. Why should I believe you when you say that? Gallup, and that's the kind of opinion polling Gallup wanted to do, but he wanted to sell it to newspapers. He had 150 newspapers that funded the American Institute for Public Opinion, which, again, was a form of journalism. And so he's like, oh, I know, I can prove to you that my surveys of opinion are reliable, because I will actually survey how people are about to vote before an election, and I'll make a prediction, and that will be the proof of my method.
Right. You know, so, Jill, what I found absolutely compelling about your piece is that right now, in 2015, we are really dealing with questions about the legitimacy of polling, the reliability, whether or not they're actually representative, whether they actually tell us anything accurate or interesting or compelling or useful about our political process. But you opened my eyes that these questions were around from Gallup's time. I mean, in 1947, you cite that Herbert Bloomer, in an address to the American Sociological Association, that he argued that really at the basis of all this is a really profound question, that whether or not this thing called public opinion even exists.
Yeah, I love the way there's been such a long conversation about this and that we forgot. I think it's important to say at the outset, like, I wrote the piece because I think these are important questions to ask, but I don't think, you know, pollsters are actually just trying to get good results. Like, polling is not a fraud. It's not some kind of a scam. Like, these people are actually trying to make predictions that can be proven to have been reliable. That's how they stay in business. So it's not that there's a scam there, but it is true that the industry has never actually sufficiently answered the questions about the very endeavor that had been raised from the start, from the 1930s. So Bloomer, this is one of my favorite pieces in 1947. You know, he looked at it as a sociologist. He's like, look, we can use surveys to ask, like, do you own a home? How many pets do you have? Like, there's a lot of reasons to ask people questions and do surveys. Like, the census is a survey. We can do sample surveys. But if we ask people, like, do you believe in God? You know, how are you going to vote in the next election? And then we say, as if we could give equal weight to the opinions expressed by anybody that we surveyed at one particular moment in time, and then we just, in the aggregate, called that thing public opinion. Bloomer's point, and he demonstrates this very convincingly, that is an insupportable assumption. I may feel one way about background checks at this moment. I might sit down with my kids at dinner, and they might make a really strong argument that differs from mine, and I might actually... begin to change my mind. Like, or I might sit down with an expert, or someone. I might sit down with someone who's been shot, who's, you know, recovered from a gunshot wound, and then I might think about it again. Like, the opinion changes, and we influence one another because we're not an aggregate of opinions.
Yeah.
We're a society.
Well, Jill, let me ask you. This is one of my favorite reasons to talk to you, because you really bring the richness of history to the table in these discussions. But I'm also wondering, from a scientific perspective, because, you know, current modern day pollsters really believe their pursuit is a scientific one. And one of the fundamental challenges of science is, in a way, like, your data is limited to the question that you ask. I mean, it's kind of a fundamental problem that's baked into the cake of any data gathering endeavor.
Yeah. And there, too, there have been a number of, you know, very carefully argued critiques of the polling industry that, you know, to do with the leadingness of questions, the ways that, you know, they're not all polls are alike. There's some very reputable pollsters who think very carefully about the methods that they use and think very carefully about the questions that they ask, and they have all kinds of controls on those. And then there are some that are not so good. But you can think about different moments in American history when polls have been quite influential, and differently so. So I think, you know, if you talk to pollsters who've been around for a long time, you know, people doing really good work, best possible work, you know, they will say that the measurement of public opinion during the Vietnam era was quite important in the end for getting us out of Vietnam, that actually tracking the dwindling popular support for the U.S. military intervention in Vietnam was hugely important as a matter of policy. And pollsters are very proud of that. Or pollsters will point to same-sex marriage. Well, there's an issue where public opinion is really shifted. But you can make counter-arguments there, too. Like, what are those questions like? And other people say, you know what, actually, the way that leading questions were asked of Americans during the Iraq War made it appear that there was far more support for that military intervention than there was. The questions were framed in such a way as to eliminate answers that suggested people had no opinion. You know, this is one of the non-opinion problem, or the non-attitude problem.
Mm. Do you wonder, I mean, is the imperfection of polling, or maybe more accurately, the imperfection of how polls are used in politics, just sort of a natural outgrowth of the truth of our democracy? It's messy. It's not perfect. You know, the powerful will always have a louder voice. And in a sense, I mean, you raise this question through some of the people you talk with in your piece, that they say that polls are a way to push back against that power, to hear from the average person.
Yeah, and you know, that's the thing. I think this is so charming, really, especially for the 1930s, to hear the idealism of these people. People who are developing public opinion measurement in the 1930s are trying to fight fascism, right? They're trying to celebrate and strengthen American democracy. And what they believe is that if you could say, okay, popular public opinion is all of our individual opinions in aggregate, and it's the most democratic form of political expression in this sense, right? That we get equal, we all have an equal political voice. It's an equalizing force, right? And that's the great promise of that work. But Gallup, when he was doing his surveys, he sent people door to door. They talked to people for 35 minutes, and their response rate was well above 90%. So almost everybody they asked, I'm here, I work for Gallup, I'd like to ask you a few questions, ma'am, people would answer. The response rate of pollsters now is in the single digits. In many cases, polls that report these horse race, some of them, you know, 2-3% response rate. Most people refuse to speak to pollsters. I mean, when someone calls your house at dinner time,
except they couldn't, because landline—that's part of the issue,
and
isn't
people
it?
People don't have landlines. I mean, there are all these kind of methodological problems, but. And so what some pollsters will say in their defense is, you know what, it's true that we don't get everybody, but, you know, the people that we have a really hard time getting are not very likely to vote, so our election predictions are pretty accurate. Well, okay, that's true. That makes your election predictions more reliable than if the people you were getting were not voting. But what about the whole promise, the whole argument to Congress, even when Congress investigated pollsters in the 1930s and 40s, because they were worried that it was undermining of democracy? The whole argument was, look, it's equalizing political participation. It's leveling out all these asymmetries, and it's making us a better democracy. But if that's no longer true, if the only people that are responding to the polls are the people most likely to vote, because those people are, then we're sort of disenfranchising ourselves.
Well, so maybe it's time for me to ask you. I mean, the question, the really basic, important question that you ask in your New Yorker piece is all this polling bad for our democracy? What do you think?
You know, I think this is a good moment to maybe have a conversation about it, because classical 1930s era public opinion polling really is not doing very well, and it is being replaced by something else, which is quite different, which is data science and data analytics. And I think before we completely make that turn, we maybe ought to ask whether it's going to be a good one. I don't have a solution. I mean, I know, you know, at WBUR, I mean, I assume you guys had conversations about starting polling, doing your own polling. You know, was that a good decision or a bad decision? And people would say, a lot of critics would say, media organizations should not be doing their own polling. That's making news instead of reporting on it. I mean, I think there's real ethical questions for media organizations that haven't been asked or certainly haven't been answered well. So I think because it's going to be easier for you to do that polling using some Twitter tool or new Facebook tool in, you know, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months a year.
Right.
Maybe this is a time for everyone, including, you know, your own organization, to say, what is this as journalism? What is this as politics?
You know, as I was reading your article, for some reason, that quote from Winston Churchill kept popping into my mind about that democracy is the worst form of government except for all the others. And it made me wonder if, you know, polling is the worst form of information gathering about a democracy except for all the others.
Churchill, not a fan of polls, quite opposed to polls.
Okay, really? Wow. So overall, I mean, you mentioned data analytics and data mining, which is a huge deal, and becoming, like, the Obama campaign in 2008 really took it to a new level. But and now it's sort of part of the American political process. I'm wondering if there's the possibility, and maybe, you know, you kind of hinted that maybe you don't know the answer to this, but I want to ask it anyway. Is there a possibility that is the solution to the long-term solution to our current polling problem, that we're throwing out, the average American just throwing out so much data as it is, that the old-fashioned pollster will go the way of the dodo, and that's okay?
Well, the old-fashioned pollster is. I mean, there was this great comment at a hearing in Congress this summer where pollsters referred to as going the way of blacksmiths. So, you know, that change is upon us, and it is essentially unstoppable. But I guess where I would raise an alarm about what you've just said, which is that somehow that the data science will be perfect and will perfectly represent the opinions of the average American. There's this wonderful book called The Averaged American that's about the history of this effort to find the average American and the many forms of bias, and especially racial exclusion, that this represents. Even Gallup, you know, I mean, he the guy was really well-intentioned. You know, these are not sinister people. These are people who really try out their, you know, the pollsters really want to do good. And, you know, but he looked at the South and he thought, you know, these blacks don't vote. They can't vote. You know, you can't register to vote in the South. You get beaten up. So he just didn't send anybody out really to ask blacks questions. You know, he used a quota for all populations, but he didn't even assign what was called the Negro quota in the South, because he just was like, well, they're not really gonna they're not gonna get a vote. I'm not gonna take them in. And I think you can say, okay, that's a human failing, but there are many human failings behind what we think of as the kind of the cold hand of technology.
Well, Jill Lepore is a Harvard historian and staff writer for The New Yorker. Her new article in The New Yorker is Politics and the New Machine, What the Turn from Polls to Data Science science means for democracy. Jill Lepore, always great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
So much fun to talk to you as well.
Well, Jill mentioned the fact that WBUR does do political polling. That is absolutely true. So let's turn now for a response to Steve Cazella. He's president of the Mass Inc. polling group and the man who does the polling for WBUR. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
So I'm wondering, I mean, what do you make of Jill Lepore's analysis about the concerns about the fallibility of polling and whether or not media organizations should even be doing it?
Well, certainly some of it reflects and echoes arguments that, as Jill points out, have been made for quite a long time. I think some of the things that she suggests are perhaps a bit jumbled or misleading in the sense that, the facts that were just discussed, like, you know, that election polls tend to focus on people more likely to vote. Well, that doesn't mean that you can't measure the opinion of people who are not likely to vote, which would be what you would do if you were doing a general election poll, or I'm sorry, a general population poll. So I think there were that and a couple other points where I would, you know, take exception to some of the, not some of the facts themselves, but the way they were strung together to sort of imply something about polls that I don't know that I'd be on board with.
Well, Steve, let me ask for your response on one thing that Jill Lepore pointed out, and she's not the only one, that there is a basic new huge challenge here wherein the response rates are in the single digits, that, you know, how can you be sure that you're getting a truly representative sample?
There is. That is very true. And that, I think, is also something that has been quite a lot of discussion of. You know, response rates are something that's been studied extensively and is studied anew every year. What we're finding so far is that it doesn't really correlate with accuracy. It's something that we can't readily explain why it doesn't, but it doesn't so far. You know, the polls, for the most part, you know, with obvious and notable and well-known exceptions, have done a pretty good job recently. You know, they've missed by a few points here and there, but, you know, if you ask somebody 30 or 40 years ago, what would a poll give you if you had a 5 or 10% response rate, they would probably guess that it would be totally worthless, not that it might miss by 2 points or might miss by 4 points.
Well, Steve, we've just literally got 30 seconds, but I do want to give you a chance to give us your two cents on what do you think polling does do or provide for our democracy?
Well, that's another thing about that she mentioned about the Iraq War, and I would point out that there's always the option in polls to say, I don't know. That's always, always, always an option. So I think what polls are really people's voices. You know, it's people speaking in a way that's organized to their leaders. You know, we would probably be still talking about Boston 2024 right now if the WBUR poll didn't exist, for instance.
Right. Well, so. Steve Cazella is the president of the Mass Inc. Polling Group, and he is the person who does polling for WBUR, responding to Jill Lepore's article in The New Yorker. Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
There's more of the show coming up in just a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.